Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
My talk, as you know, is called Getting to Know Tolkien and Lewis and Why It's Worth Your Time. J.R.R. Tolkien triumphed over a lonely mountain of suffering. The chapters of his life ring out like an epic catalog. The sad arc from South Africa to Birmingham, with his father's death defining his early childhood. His mother's conversion to the Church of Rome, her diabetic martyrdom in isolation from her Protestant family, the saving intervention of the Eratians and the charismatic stamp left on them by two saints, Philip Neri and John Henry Newman, the Oxford degree in English language and literature, the delayed marriage to Edith Bratt, the front line and trench fever, the academic rise, the growing family, C.S. Lewis and the Inklings, the creation of Middle Earth. It is the stuff of legend. C.S. Lewis's life was also marked by challenges. He lost his mother when he was 9. He also served at the front and faced the unspeakable horrors of machine guns and barbed wire. Like Tolkien, he came to Oxford from a foreign country, though Ireland, before the days of the Republic, was a British colony. The two great men had been tested in ways that prompted fellow feeling and mutual understanding. We may say that fate or providence prepared a common ground between them. They also shared a cultural and literary inheritance. Both were born into the Protestant faith, though Tolkien, as a young boy, elected to follow his mother's lead and convert to the Church of Rome. When he went up to Exeter College, Oxford in 1911, he joined the small minority of Catholic undergraduates. There were only 99 of them at Oxford University, slightly over 10% of the total. As a professor, he would take part in the Catholic march toward full acceptance in Oxford's Protestant milieu. Lewis's conversion story is more dramatic. His youthful faith flickered out, came roaring back, and flickered out again. He recounted with shame how he endured the rite of confirmation and First Communion to satisfy his father. Quote, "I allowed myself to be prepared for confirmation and to make my First Communion in total disbelief, acting a part, eating and drinking my own condemnation." Lewis was not a believing Christian when he arrived at University College, Oxford in 1917. He was nonetheless welcomed by the Protestant establishment. As regards literature, the passionate world of Arthurian romance held a powerful grip on the boyhoods of Tolkien and Lewis. Tolkien's early delight in the tales of King Arthur set him down a path that would wind and weave but stay true to its origins. Lewis was 16 when he announced his satisfaction at having nearly finished Malory's Morte d'Arthur. Tolkien's remark in On Fairy Stories that King Arthur was probably once historical, but perhaps as such not of great importance, finds an echo in Lewis's scholarly insistence in 1959, "We may without disgrace believe in a historical Arthur." In fact, the vast majority of scholars had considered the historical Arthur a lost cause until quite recently, a philologist named Andrew Breese made a strong case in Tolkien's favor. Fantasy and romance supplied a range of influences for Tolkien and Lewis, from the sensual world of William Morris to the eternal boyhood of J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan. Finally, we may mention as a general reference point, Tennyson's Idylls of the King, which, appearing between 1859 and 1885, helped establish the Victorian vogue for Arthuriana. It is no accident that Queen Victoria named her third son Arthur. In Tolkien, Aragorn and Boromir are literary descendants of Arthur and his Knights of the Round Table. In Lewis, the Pevensey children likewise bear the stamp of Arthurian legend. It will help us to coordinate Tolkien's and Lewis's timelines. John Ronald Reuel Tolkien was born on January 3, 1892 in Bloemfontein, South Africa. He had one sibling, his younger brother, Hilary. His father, Arthur, that name again, born in 1857, came from the Birmingham area in the West Midlands of England. To improve his middle-class fortunes, he left the country, learned Dutch, and took a job at the Bank of Africa. His fiancée, a governess named Mabel Suffield, joined him in South Africa in 1891, and soon they married. Though we have no record of her formal education, Mabel Tolkien would teach her sons Latin, French, and German. She had taken them for a visit back to England when, in 1896, Arthur Tolkien died of a fever. She chose to remain in Birmingham. In 1900, she converted to Catholicism, alienating much of her family. Before she perished from diabetes in 1904, at the age of 34, she became friendly with members of the Oratory of St. Philip Neri. The Oratians had come to Birmingham in 1848 under the leadership of John Henry Newman. Tolkien survived his orphaned adolescence thanks to the Oratians, as well as to extended family and the respectable Protestant middle class. A flamboyant and generous Oratian priest named Francis Xavier Morgan took a special interest in the Tolkien boy. It was Father Francis who supervised, sometimes very strictly, Tolkien's romantic relationship with Edith Bratt, whom he met in 1908 and would marry in 1916. Lewis was better off. Born in Belfast, Ireland in 1898, he grew up in a spacious brick-built house furnished in bourgeois splendor and supported by domestic servants. He had one sibling, his older brother Warren, or Warney, 3 years his senior. Lewis writes in his autobiography, quote, "I am a product of long corridors, empty sunlit rooms, upstairs indoor silences, attics explored in solitude, distant noises of gurgling cisterns and pipes, and the wind under the tiles, also of endless books." Lewis's father, Albert, was a highly regarded police court solicitor in Belfast. His mother, Florence Lewis, died of cancer in 1908 at age 46. It happened on her husband's 45th birthday. College educated with outstanding ability in logic and math, she played chess, devoured good novels, and wrote fiction. Lewis's love of War and Peace was a maternal inheritance, which came to him with her editions of Tolstoy's books. Like Mabel Tolkien, Flora Lewis taught her son French and Latin. Ronald Tolkien, as he was known, started formal schooling in 1900 at his father's alma mater, King Edward School in Birmingham. A Protestant uncle helped foot the bill so Ronald could attend this fine, centuries-old school, where he competed in the annual Latin debates, displaying skill in Latin, Greek, Gothic, and Old English. A smallish but enthusiastic athlete, he played like a devil on the rugby pitch. Unlike Lewis, Tolkien enjoyed sports. He first encountered Shakespeare at King Edward's and recoiled in disgust. Later in life, he would remember, quote, "the bitter disappointment and disgust from school days with the shabby use made in Shakespeare of the coming of great Birnam Wood to high Dunsinane Hill. I longed to devise a setting by which the trees might really march to war." Of course, that's Macbeth he's referring to. But if Shakespeare's Macbeth did not charm the young Tolkien, Chaucer did. With the help of a good teacher, Tolkien found his way into Middle English and the Canterbury Tales. By 1907, he was at work on a series of invented languages. Around this time, he gave a presentation to the school library on two books by G.K. Chesterton, Heretics, 1905, and Orthodoxy, 1908. Chesterton is another figure who connects Tolkien and Lewis. His influence as a Christian artist and intellectual is profound. In his final year at King Edward's, 1910-1911, Tolkien ran the school library, joining with three other librarian classmates in what they called the Tea Club Barrovian Society, or TCBS. So try to remember that TCBS, it'll come back. The Tea Club Barrovian Society. The pious young men of the TCBS swore friendship for life, but two of them would die in the war. Incidentally, on departing King Edward's, Tolkien, the young librarian, forgot to return the finished epic, the Kalevala. Despite Albert Lewis's best intentions, his son Jack spent 1908-1910 at the lamentable Wynyard School, an English prep school that Lewis later compared to a concentration camp. Its proximity to a good church was an unexpected blessing that briefly revived Lewis's faith. After Wynyard School, he spent a number of weeks in 1910 at Campbell College, Belfast. Ill health sent him home halfway through the term. His next stop was back in England at a prep school at Malvern called Cherbourg House. He studied there from 1911 to 1913. You see, the war is creeping up. The war starts in 1914. And thanks to a headmaster who spurred his studies in English and Latin, he started making strides in his education. As regards his spiritual formation, Lewis's revival of faith did not survive the influences of Cherbourg House. After winning a classical entrance scholarship to Malvern College, he remained there only a year, 1913 to 1914, before moving on to study privately at Great Bookham, Surrey, with his father's former headmaster, the brilliant if severe educator William T. Kirkpatrick, a Scotsman. Lewis referred to the period under Kirkpatrick's tutelage from fall 1914 to March 1917 as, quote, by merely natural standards, the most fortunate thing that ever happened to me. What did Kirkpatrick, an atheist who admired Schopenhauer and Fraser's Golden Bough, teach Lewis? He instructed him in the trivium, the medieval curriculum comprising logic, grammar, and rhetoric. Kirkpatrick wielded logic like a master swordsman, and he was not humble about his supremacy. Lewis's devotion to logical argument stems from his dialectical thrashings at the hands of Kirkpatrick, whom he affectionately called the Great Knock. He also received hard correction in Greek and Latin grammar, especially in Homer and Virgil. Lewis's counterpart to Tolkien's linguistic invention was his childhood creation of an imaginary world known as Boxen. The Boxen stories, in which the talking animals of animal land interact with human beings, developed into an adolescent tour de force. Undoubtedly, the young Lewis recognized his growing powers, his mastery of idiom, and the delicious effects of his high-caliber wit. And while I like Lewis's boyhood poems, they lack the stylistic verve of Boxen at its best. Lewis later summed up the situation, quote, in mapping and chronicling animal land, I was training myself to be a novelist. Note well, a novelist, not a poet. My invented world was full for me of interest, bustle, humor, and character. But there was no poetry, even no romance in it. It was almost astonishingly prosaic. This invented world was not, in the highest sense, imaginative, end quote. It seems to me that Lewis took his enormous gift for prose writing for granted. It came so naturally to him. It is a typical human phenomenon. When we're really, really good at something, we tend to just think nothing of it because it comes so naturally to me. That's the kind of prose writer Lewis was. Unlike Lewis, Tolkien managed to complete his Oxford degree before joining the war. It wasn't an easy feat. Entering Exeter College at age 19, he started slowly, being inclined to enjoy his new freedom and to chart his own intellectual life. He came close to losing his indispensable scholarship. He turned things around during his second year, however, plunging deeper into Greek and Latin authors. After that, it was a steady diet of Old English and Middle English. When war broke out in August 1914, he defied the relentless social pressure that drove a million young men to enlist by year's end. Exeter would lose a third of the undergraduates who matriculated beside him. In September 1914, Tolkien wrote The Voyage of Arendel the Evenstar, an early poetic glimmer of Middle Earth. He hung on at Exeter to take his final examination in 1915, earned a first-class honors degree in English language and literature, and then immediately started military training. Having married Edith in March 1916 and seen his book of poems rejected, he shipped out to France in June. In November of that year, 1916, as the army's bungling leadership swelled the cemeteries of France, Second Lieutenant Tolkien returned to England with a severe case of trench fever, which was carried by lice. In the following months, he started work on a number of tales, including The Fall of Gondolin, where his invented languages came into play. These tales would eventually be absorbed into the Silmarillion. Let's grab a sip of water. Back in Surrey, the Great Knock succeeded in preparing Lewis for his scholarship examination at Oxford, which tested him on general knowledge, classics, logic, and mathematics. Lewis's Achilles heel was mathematics, algebra, and sums. He failed twice to pass the mathematics exam. Algebra and sums. This genius had a hard time with algebra and sums. Had it not been for an easing of the rules for war veterans, Oxford would have dropped him. As it happened, Lewis interrupted his undergraduate career after only a few months, waived his exemption as an Irishman, and joined the British Army in June 1917. 5 months later, he was fighting in France, where he was wounded in battle in April 1918. In his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, he describes making friends in the trenches with a brilliant young man named Lawrence B. Johnson, who stands in parallel to Tolkien's lost friends, Geoffrey Smith and Rob Gilson, the TCBS men who perished in France. Johnson, a scholarship student at Oxford, was killed by the same bomb that wounded Lewis. When we think of the best English poetry of the First World War, we think of the disillusioned Wilfred Owen and what he called the old lie, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, sweet and decorous it is to die for the fatherland. Lewis and Tolkien held a less bitter view, which cannot be separated from their grief over their fallen comrades. This grief, in turn, nurtured an ethos rooted in an ideal of Christian knighthood. Tolkien's career moved quickly after the war. He and Edith returned to Oxford, where Tolkien went to work at the New English Dictionary, later the Oxford English Dictionary, tracing the etymology of words like wasp and walrus. Etymology is the study of the history of words, and Tolkien naturally excelled at it. He picked up work on the side as a freelance tutor. From fall 1920 into 1925, he rose through the ranks as reader in English language and then professor of English language at Leeds University, where he co-edited an edition of a medieval Arthurian poem, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. In 1925, he applied for the professorship of Anglo-Saxon at Oxford. The hiring process came down to a tie-breaking vote in his favor by the vice chancellor. He started in fall 1925, and his growing family returned to Oxford early in 1926, the year he and Lewis met. In the summer of 1918, we find Second Lieutenant Lewis convalescing from his bomb injury and reading Chesterton with pleasure. The war ended in November 1918, and Lewis returned to Oxford early the next year. Later in 1919, under the pseudonym Clive Hamilton, he published his first book of poems, Spirits in Bondage. The return to civilian life left Lewis in a precarious position of looking after the mother and sister of his slain comrade, Paddy Moore. The official story was that Paddy, having died in the war, left his friend Lewis to honor their pact by looking after his maternal parent, not unlike the beloved disciple. Certainly, Lewis's undergraduate housing arrangements were highly irregular, as he shepherded Mrs. Moore and her daughter Maureen from house to house in the Oxford suburbs. Lewis's undergraduate major, as we would say, or subject, as he would have said, was Literae Humaniores, the more humane letters, elsewhere known as classics, but at Oxford known as Lit Hume. Accordingly, Lewis immersed himself in the written records of the ancient world, its languages, literature, history, and philosophy. His chosen course of study had two parts, honors moderations, or mods, and final honors school, or greats. Lewis's first class honors in both sets of exams is called a double first. In 1919, he befriended Owen Barfield, whose landmark work, Poetic Diction, would appear in 1928. I shall return to it. Lewis took his double first in 1922, and supported by his generous father, went on the next year to take a first in English language and literature. In 1924, he received a one-year appointment as a tutor at University College. The next year, he was elected a fellow at Magdalen College. It looks like Magdalen College, but they say Magdalen. So an interesting point is that Tolkien and Lewis were both getting in kind of on the ground floor of modern English studies. It was really just starting to gather momentum, and they played a seminal role in this happening at Oxford. Lewis's diary records the first meeting between him and Tolkien on May 11, 1926, at an English faculty meeting. Lewis describes his new acquaintance, quote, "He is a smooth, pale, fluent little chap." If you recall, I suggested at the start of my paper that fate had laid a common groundwork in their similar experience of suffering and survival. We may add now that Lewis's return to Christianity proved determinant for what happened between him, Tolkien, and the group that came to be known as the Inklings. You guys heard of the Inklings? Heard of the Inklings, yeah. Lewis, the young Oxford tutor, like Lewis the soldier and Lewis the undergraduate, did not believe in God. This atheism yielded under the pressure of philosophy to the abstract sense of God that English Hegelian philosophers called the absolute. It was in September 1931 that Lewis, in the company of Tolkien and future Inkling Hugo Dyson, ventured on a stroll through the grounds of Magdalen College alongside a river footpath called Addison's Walk. Their long conversation about myth and metaphor owed something to Chesterton's Everlasting Man and something to Lewis's friend Owen Barfield. Lewis, to his surprise and dismay, was teetering ever closer to belief in Christianity as the true myth. That's the key phrase, Christianity as the true myth. Finally, the same month, he raised the white flag of surrender and accepted that Christ is the Son of God. The word clubbable appears rarely in American English. It is more frequent in England thanks to Dr. Johnson and a Dickens character named Samuel Pickwick, founder of the fictional Pickwick Club. There is a distinctly male tilt to it. Tolkien was a clubbable man, and biographers are right to see the TCBS as a foreshadowing of the Inklings. As an undergraduate, Tolkien joined with some rowdy friends to form the Apolostics, a pun on apostolic, by way of a dictionary word meaning concerned with seeking enjoyment. At the University of Leeds, he joined the Viking Club, reveling in sagas, comic songs, and beer. As an Oxford professor, Tolkien formed the Kolbitar, or Kolbiters, a reference to idle Icelanders sitting around the fire. Kolbiters, a faculty group that met to translate the Icelandic sagas. Lewis also proved to be highly clubbable. He had only one close boyhood friend, Arthur Greaves, but it was a lifelong friendship founded on literary enthusiasms. As an undergraduate, he belonged to a literary society called the Martlets, serving the group as secretary and as president. As a tutor at Magdalen College, he encountered Tolkien not only among the Kolbiters, but also among the undergraduates who met Wednesday nights for beer and Beowulf. You guys have a beer and Beowulf session here? Lewis soaked up Elizabethan drama in the Mermaid Club and philosophy and literature in the Michaelmas Club. In the early 1930s, he and Tolkien established a group called The Cave, which included women and amounted to yet another literary club. To leap ahead, Lewis served as the first president of the coeducational Socratic Club, where in 1948, in a famous incident, the philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe poked a hole in his argument that naturalism is self-refuting. The greatest of all the clubs I've mentioned was ecumenically Christian and exclusively male. Its narrow demographics reflect its insular nature and its intensity. Friendship was the heart of it, most of all the friendship between Tolkien and Lewis, which took firm root in the late 1920s. A key event in the story of that friendship dates from late 1929, when Tolkien shared with Lewis a draft of an important poem called Tenuvial, better known today as the Lay of Lathian. Its subject is the romance of Beren and Lúthien, the heroic lovers from the work in progress that became the Silmarillion. Tolkien found the warmth and seriousness of Lewis's response to be most encouraging. As regards the origins of the Inklings, Simon Harbin, in his recent book, C.S. Lewis's Oxford, explains that there were two versions of the Inklings. Harbin describes the earlier version as a kind of creative writing club. Founded by an undergraduate, the original Inklings met to share and critique other members' compositions. Lewis and Tolkien attended meetings of the society as senior members. It was at one of their meetings that Tolkien read his poem Errantry, later published in the Oxford Magazine. Harbin also quotes a Tolkien letter of 1967, which I will share with you. Tolkien and Lewis don't seem to have referred to each other as Jack and Ronald. They tended to refer to each other by their last names. Tolkien was known to some friends as Tollers. In his letters, Tolkien refers to Lewis as CSL for Clive Staples Lewis, and that's what you're going to hear now is CSL. I think it's cool because there are some writers that just get their own initials, so TSE is TSLE and CSL is C.S. Lewis. I'm sure there are some others. Here's Tolkien writing in 1967, looking back on the founding of the Inklings. The Inklings' name was transferred by Lewis to the undetermined and unelected circle of friends who gathered about CSL and met in his rooms in Magdalen. Although our habit was to read aloud compositions of various kinds and lengths, this association and its habit would in fact have come into being at this time, whether the original short-lived club ever existed or not. CSL had a passion for hearing things read aloud. I love that. I just adore that. CSL had a passion for hearing things read aloud, a power of memory for things received in that way, and also a felicity in extempore criticism, none of which were shared, especially not the last, in anything like the same degree by his friends. Alongside their original readings, discussion topics ranged widely. They included such varied fare as cremation, cannibalism, the possibility of dogs having souls, A.E. Housman, The Song of Roland, philology, the Bible, women, and the Ancien Régime. The Inklings in their prime had two locations and times. On Thursday evenings, they met at Lewis's room in Magdalen College, and on Tuesday mornings, they convened at the Eagle and Child, a pub known familiarly as the Bird and Baby. Isn't that just great? Tuesday mornings, looks like a typo. But there they were, convening at the a pub known familiarly as the Bird and Baby. I hasten to add that when World War II broke out and beer shortages plagued the land, the Inklings sought and found refuge in other public houses, public house being a pub. Aside from regular meetings, they liked to get out and tour the countryside on foot. The Inklings were an informal aggregation. They kept no record book or notes. Diaries and letters supply the bulk of what we know. Tolkien and Lewis formed the core, but Lewis's brother Warney was there from the start, and several Oxford colleagues belonged to the inner circle, including David Cecil, Hugo Dyson, and Neville Coghill, prominent scholars and writers. There was a local doctor named Robert Havard, whom Lewis honored by naming the physician in Perelandra after him. Known to his friends as the useless quack, Havard also contributed an appendix to Lewis's 1940 volume, The Problem of Pain, which is dedicated to the Inklings. Though we tend to think of the great Inklings as four in number, Tolkien and Lewis, along with Owen Barfield and novelist Charles Williams, so Tolkien, Lewis, Barfield, and Williams, those are the big four. The truth is that Barfield's attendance was spotty and Williams was a latecomer. Barfield lived in London, earning his bread as a lawyer. He always resented that. He was a brilliant man. Williams joined the group at Lewis's insistence, but Tolkien never really warmed to him. Tolkien's son, Christopher, was another late joining member. He took on the job of reading Tolkien's work in progress, The Lord of the Rings, because his father was a poor reader of his own writing. I find this father-son arrangement curious and fascinating. One thinks of Tolkien as a man whose inscrutable depths radiated mystical authority, a creator emanating power, much as the one in the Silmarillion emanates power through intermediaries into the created cosmos. Since I have highlighted the independent and insular nature of the group, it will enlarge your view if I note some of its larger connections. Charles Williams achieved the near miraculous feat of befriending both T.S. Eliot and C.S. Lewis. Lewis hated Eliot. You have to understand, he detested him. You may detect the influence of Williams' novels, spiritual thrillers, they have been called, on Eliot's 1939 play, The Family Reunion. Likewise, you may detect the influence of Williams' Oxford lectures on Lewis's preface to Paradise Lost, published in 1942. Towards the end of the war, Williams arranged for the modernist Eliot and the anti-modernist Lewis to meet face to face. By all accounts, the meeting did not go well. Historian David Cecil, who was part of the inner circle, wrote President John Kennedy's favorite novel, The Young Melbourne. And now I have to insert the strange fact that today is the anniversary of John Kennedy's assassination, but also of the death of C.S. Lewis. So, and it's interesting to think that Cecil, Jack Kennedy, there's another Jack, two Jacks died on November 22nd. He loved that book, Melbourne, which is about a Whig politician, a guy, kind of a ladies' man, this fellow Melbourne in the novel, not unlike President Kennedy, to tell you the truth. John Wayne, one of Lewis's students, joined the group for a time, thus forming a link between the Inklings and Wayne's close friends, Philip Larkin and Kingsley Amis, leading lights among the younger generation and the literary school known as the Movement. Finally, after The Lord of the Rings appeared in the 1950s, Tolkien found an unexpected ally in his former student, the poet W.H. Auden. Auden was, I think, the most important of the modernist defenders of Tolkien. W.H. Auden, I would call a great poet. But though they were not isolated from the currents of the world, the spirit of the group was profoundly countercultural. Its adherence to Christian dogma and its resistance to modernity's triumphant self-regard set it apart. It was reactionary both in its loyalty to virtue ethics and in its refusal of stylistic experimentations. The Inklings do not traffic in stream of consciousness or cinematic montage. The group was neither misogynistic nor anti-Semitic, and that is so, I think, impressive coming out of the 30s. Not a trace of anti-Semitism, but it was almost mystically masculine and united by an understated warrior ethos that we should not overlook. Tolkien, Lewis, Barfield, Dyson, and Coghill served in World War I. Another member, Jim Dundas Grant, commanded the Oxford University Naval Division during World War II, while Christopher Tolkien served as a pilot in the Royal Air Force. Being aware of these common bonds helps us better appreciate the literary output of the Inklings and why it bears the mark of defiance. What follows then is an interwoven commentary on some of the works produced by these men. I will start with Barfield's 1928 work, Poetic Diction, A Study in Meaning. Although Barfield never became a Lord of the Rings fan, Tolkien nevertheless learned a great deal from Barfield's treatment of myth and imagination. The gist of Barfield's linguistic impact on Tolkien is captured by biographer Humphrey Carpenter, quote, "In the dawn of language," said Barfield, "speakers did not make a distinction between the literal and the metaphorical, but used words in what might be called a mythological manner." Barfield's aim in Poetic Diction was to recover the original unity that, in his view, characterized language and myth before scientific analysis broke things up into so many bits and pieces. For Barfield, the words spirit, inspiration, and respiration share an essential mythological identity. Think of the wind god, Spiritus. Tolkien, in his 1936 lecture, Beowulf, The Monsters and the Critics, follows Barfield when he writes, quote, "The significance of a myth is not easily to be pinned on paper by analytical reasoning. It is at its best when it is presented by a poet who feels rather than makes explicit what his theme portends." Let me just read that. "The significance of a myth is not easily to be pinned on paper by analytical reasoning. It is at its best when it is presented by a poet who feels rather than makes explicit what his theme portends, who presents it incarnate in the world of history and geography," end quote. These words comment both on Beowulf and on Tolkien's creation of Middle-earth. Having failed to become a famous poet, Lewis found his greatest success in the Chronicles of Narnia, published between 1950 and 1956. He found his first creative success, however, as a Christian satirist. I just want to put in a plug for Christian satirists, by the way. Christian satirist, fine, rare tribe. The title of his 1933 novel, The Pilgrim's Regress, alludes to John Bunyan's 1678 classic, The Pilgrim's Progress. Lewis was a stunningly complex author, whom we should not regard simply as the author of children's books, however brilliant and lasting. I will quote here from some excellent criticism by Kevin Rouleau in his discussion of The Pilgrim's Regress. Writes Rouleau, quote, "The book resembles satiric modernist works in several ways. For example, despite its use of allegory, a technique not normally associated with modernism, the novel at the same time adopts a densely elusive texture, including a winding maze of power and intertextual elements through which the reader must navigate. The Pilgrim's Regress thus offers a similar strategy to Joyce's Ulysses, which Lewis claimed not to have read, and perhaps even more tellingly to Eliot's The Wasteland, which Lewis certainly knew and ridiculed. I think this is right, and what I ask you to take away from it is that Lewis, despite his protestations, was less removed from the modernist zeitgeist than Tolkien was. From the psychology of the Screwtape Letters to the bureaucratic babble of that hideous strength, Lewis's satire reveals him as modernity's double agent, steeped in the society he abhors. Doesn't that strike a nerve for so many of us? His 1955 autobiography, Surprised by Joy, is as sophisticated as Proust, not least in its sexual frankness, a quality that Tolkien eschewed. As scholars, Tolkien and Lewis rank among the best medievalists of all time. Beowulf stands on the cusp of the medieval era, and its proximity to pagan terror has made an indelible imprint on Tolkien's imagination. Dragons are medieval, so is the Green Dragon Inn. The matter of Britain, as scholars refer to the Arthurian legends, is medieval. Tolkien compiled the glossary of Middle English vocabulary for a major scholarly work published in 1922, entitled 14th Century Verse and Prose. You will recall that I mentioned Tolkien's early attraction to Chaucer. He lectured at Oxford on Chaucer for decades, and the collected lectures, will be published early next year. On Lewis's side of the scholarly ledger, we should note two important works that concern the Middle Ages. First, The Allegory of Love, a study in medieval tradition from 1936, treats the origins and developments of the courtly love tradition in Europe, from the troubadours to Edmund Spenser. That book was a massive hit for the Oxford in the 30s, and men and women, young men and women, would flock to these lectures to hear Lewis talk, hold forth about the romance tradition in English literature. Second, from Lewis, The Discarded Image, a posthumous work published in 1964, has the range of a mini encyclopedia unified by the author's historical vision. It is typical of Lewis's pugnacity that for decades he battled the great tide of Renaissance studies. Quote, this is Lewis, catch that stubbornness. I do not believe in the Renaissance as generally described by historians. The more I look into the evidence, the less trace I find of that vernal rapture, which is supposed to have swept Europe in the 15th century. Lewis lost that fight, but he nevertheless changed our understanding of the boundary between the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. If we turn away from their scholarship and back into the realm of creative endeavor, we find that the economy and technology of Middle Earth and Narnia are medieval. In consequence, our sense of scale and distance changes. Moreover, medievalism for Tolkien and Lewis extends to their ideals of social and cosmic order. A common source for both is Boethius, whose consolation of philosophy resolves the paradoxes of free will and necessity, eternity and time, and providence and fate. Boethius sets a high premium on the faculty of reason, as does Tolkien in On Fairy Stories, and Lewis in the very grain of his creative and critical work. Both writers delight in the cosmic power of music, an idea that goes back to Pythagoras and Plato and blossoms in the higher learning of the Middle Ages, with Boethius again playing a major role. One thinks of the music of the spheres, which we find in Dante, Chaucer, and Shakespeare. Tolkien's creation myth in the Silmarillion begins with Eru, the one creating the Ainur, the holy ones, and, quote, propounding to them themes of music. And they sang before him, and he was glad. Lewis's equivalent figure, Aslan, is described in The Magician's Nephew as singing his new song. It was softer and more lilting than the song by which he had called up the stars and the sun, a gentle rippling music, thus the creation of Narnia. Lewis's space trilogy, dating from 1938 to 1945, takes place in a modified version of the medieval cosmos where, as in Chaucer's The Knight's Tale, Venus and Mars are both gods and planets. And since I mentioned Dante, I would add that the author of the Commedia made a greater impact on Lewis than on Tolkien, as we find in the purgatorial effects of the Great Divorce, Until We Have Faces. It's astonishing. Tolkien seems to deflect the influence of Shakespeare and deflect the influence of Dante. So talk about a singularity of an author. On the subject of magic, one must remember that for Tolkien and Lewis, the use of magic is a touchstone for distinguishing good from evil. Lewis's remarks on magic from his 1944 work, The Abolition of Man, help us see why both writers placed such emphasis upon it. So this is Lewis from The Abolition of Man. There was very little magic in the Middle Ages. The 16th and 17th centuries are the high noon of magic. The serious magical endeavor and the serious scientific endeavor are twins. One was sickly and died, the other strong and throve. They were born of the same impulse. There is something which unites magic and applied science while separating both from the wisdom of earlier ages. For the wise men of old, the cardinal problem had been how to conform the soul to reality, and the solution had been knowledge, self-discipline, and virtue. For magic and applied science alike, the problem is how to subdue reality to the wishes of men. The solution is a technique, and both in the practice of this technique are ready to do things hitherto regarded as disgusting and impious. This reminds me, I remember my late mother asking why Pope Benedict took exception to the Harry Potter novels. But Benedict was worried about this facility with magic, just as exercising kind of power for its own sake. He recognized its kinship to modern technology, this fantasy of total control over nature. Guilty looks from the Harry Potter fans. Sorry about that. I've never even read those books. For Tolkien and Lewis, evil magic symbolized the desire to subdue reality to the wishes of men. Morgoth, Sauron, Saruman, and the White Witch are exemplars of evil magic, corruptors of nature, and symbols of modernity's unnatural power. And on fairy stories, Tolkien defends good magic. The magic of faerie is not an end in itself. So fairy, but with the three, he's got the diéresis over the E. The magic of faerie is not an end in itself. Its virtue is in its operations. Among these are the satisfactions of certain primordial human desires. One of these desires is to survey the depths of space and time. Another is to hold communion with other living things. You can understand what the birds are saying. That's a desire of good magic, to understand what the birds are saying. In other words, good magic participates in the good of creation. In the Chronicles of Narnia, Aslan gives Diggory an apple to heal his mother. The seeds from the apple grow into a tree from whose wood the famous wardrobe is constructed. Good magic can be abused, much as Saruman abuses the Palantir. But bad magic remains dangerous because it entices our will to power, our libido dominandi, as St. Augustine called it. Because Tolkien's characters tend to be either fundamentally good or fundamentally evil, none of them has the subtle complexity of Shakespeare's Hamlet or Lear. But the presence of magic complicates things. Hobbits are impressive because they do not easily succumb to evil magic. One reason is their natural innocence. Tom Bombadil is so innocent that the ring has no power over him at all. Boromir succumbs. Sam Gamgee, like Bilbo, gives up the ring of his own accord. Frodo and Gollum cannot do so, and their close relationship enriches the trilogy beyond the scope of its alarms, marches, and battles. Because it is Gollum's fate to arouse Frodo's pity, the history of the ring invites a deeper understanding of God's providence and of humanity itself. And this deepening was manifested to Tolkien during his process of composition. When he wrote The Hobbit, Tolkien did not know the history of Bilbo's ring. Christopher Tolkien explains, quote, "From the nature of the Lord of the Rings as it evolved, the Hobbit was drawn into Middle-earth and transformed. But as The Hobbit stood in 1937, it was not part of Middle-earth. Its significance for Middle-earth lies in what it would do, not what it was." It was in the wake of The Hobbit's success that Tolkien, pressured by his publisher, intuited that The Hobbit's link to his greater mythology was Bilbo's ring, which proved to be the catalyst of pity as well as self-knowledge. These qualities distinguish Tolkien's work from Christopher Marlowe's Renaissance play, Dr. Faustus. In our short conversation over here, we managed to mention Marlowe's Dr. Faustus as well as Lear and Hamlet. So Marlowe's Dr. Faustus may invite pity at the end, but he trades self-knowledge for the constant intoxication of power, making him the all-time poster boy for magic and science gone wrong. So that's a real touchstone in a modern Western cultural history, Dr. Faustus. None of the Inklings profoundly influenced Tolkien's literary work, and I disagree with recent efforts to suggest otherwise. Lewis comments, I think rightly, quote, "No one ever influenced Tolkien. You might as well try to influence a Bandersnatch." A Bandersnatch being a creature that does not exist. What Lewis offered Tolkien was not influence, but enthusiastic support. Tolkien wrote in 1965, quote, "But for the encouragement of C.S.L., I do not think that I should ever have completed or offered for publication The Lord of the Rings," end quote. It cannot be said that this fraternal support flowed only in one direction. It was Tolkien, after all, who shared with Lewis the crucial insight of Christianity's being the true myth. Likewise, Tolkien threw his full support behind Lewis's science fiction novel, Out of the Silent Planet. Yet he never warmed to Narnia because of its mixed mythologies. That's a quote, that's a Tolkien quote. It's mixed mythologies. And his letters include a vein of backhanded compliments about Lewis's writings. I am led by this evidence to draw a strange parallel. Lewis despised Ezra Pound and the modernist movement that Pound spearheaded. Have you heard of Ezra Pound? Is that a name folks know? So the modernist movement, which included T.S. Eliot and James Joyce, Ezra Pound was a leader of that movement. But regardless of what we think of Pound and his poetry, he had the rare ability to recognize talent. In this respect, T.S. Eliot, Robert Frost, James Joyce, and Ernest Hemingway all owe a debt to Pound. To fathom what I am trying to say, you must realize that 99.9% of editors, creative writing instructors, and literary critics lack the antenna to identify first-rate talent when it is unheralded and unknown. We're as bad as economists trying to predict the future of the economy. We can't do it. This power of recognition is an exceedingly rare gift in any field of endeavor, and it often requires diplomatic skill to give it traction. It is this almost peerless capacity, a kind of sixth sense that unites Pound and Lewis. At the cores of Pound's modernist cadre and Lewis's Inklings, we find two indispensable men who could recognize greatness. Modernism, what I've just been talking about, we have Gertrude Stein, Hemingway, Fitzgerald as part of that movement, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, James Joyce. We think of Pablo Picasso among the painters. Modernism dominates the last official chapter of English literary history, in which the Inklings appear, if at all, as a footnote. But Tolkien's and Lewis's vast success, along with the high caliber scholarship they have recently attracted, continues to alter the picture. I do not think it is a question of either or, either the modernists or the Inklings. Culture warriors are unreliable where literature is concerned. Possibly the main difference between the two movements comes down to this. The modernists wrote better poems, while the Inklings told better tales. The difference between writing and telling comes into play, suggesting a modern bias against the oral culture of earlier times. And yet, it may be that oral culture is a permanent feature of human society. Remember, the Inklings, they read to each other. It's kind of bringing back that old oral culture. Mom and Dad read to many of you when you were little, and I have fond memories of my mother reading to me. We like podcasts and other vehicles of the spoken word. It follows that one should be wary of too simple a contrast between modernity and the past. I say this despite Lewis's famous warning from 1954, in his inaugural lecture as a professor of medieval and Renaissance English literature at Cambridge University. He warned us that we have entered a post-Christian desert and entirely lost our way. Lewis's taste for reaction is both provocative and exhausting. Sheer reaction never ages well, and in this respect, we must follow Eliot's advice in Four Quartets, quote, "We cannot follow an antique drum." That said, the Inkling's defiance of modernity is important because it reveals the flaws in the dominant narrative. Take, for instance, the Inkling's countercultural recognition of our religious nature. The pretensions of programmatic secularity, often associated with Marxism, shrivel in the sight of those who can really see the human situation. It is the anti-materialists, not the materialists, who have the rightful claim to the depths of thought. One thinks of Blake, Coleridge, Nietzsche, Tolstoy, Kierkegaard, Peirce, Whitehead, Heidegger, Vogel, Lonergan, and David Bentley Hart. In other words, the Inklings have a place among the major critics of scientism, materialism, and secular propaganda. Moreover, their religious beliefs support a version of environmentalism that has more staying power than Greta Thunberg and other political dayflies. Getting political here, forgive me. Last paragraph. My last point regarding why you should get to know Tolkien, Lewis, and the Inklings concerns what, for lack of a better term, I will call the Christian imagination. It is a form of knowledge that shuns the grotesque pretensions of ideology. Lewis recognized a conflict between his imagination and his powers of reason. But a conflict is not the same as a failure. Like Lewis, Charles Williams did his best to integrate philosophy and imagination. Barfield fixed on Coleridge as the central exponent of the Christian imagination. And though Tolkien preferred not to acknowledge it, Coleridge's influential writing on the poet's likeness to God informs Tolkien's theory of subcreation, where artistic creativity participates in divine creativity. It is fair to ask whether any myth, even a true myth, can resolve the conflict between science and poetry, reason and imagination. The human condition is mysterious, and self-knowledge requires that we reckon with that mystery. The Christian imagination is for exploring, for discovering new paths to beauty, for describing our impossible return when we gaze in joyful incredulity and recognize our home for the first time. Or, as Tolkien would suggest, it is a light on the road before us, a light for traveling there and back again. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.